This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Catherine Strange, Technical Analysis Manager at the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. Catherine Strange is here to tell us about the health implications of PM2.5 particulate pollution and steps being taken to reduce PM2.5 particulate pollution in the Puget Sound region. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency?
Sure. We are a local government. We are a four-county agency covering Kitsap, Snohomish, Pierce, and King counties. And our mission is to protect and improve public health and air quality specifically.
Overall, what are the key air pollution concerns in the Puget Sound region?
So we're here today to talk about PM2.5, or fine particle pollution, and certainly this is one of our biggest health risk drivers, the main health risk driver in our area. And so we are focused on reducing PM2.5. And if you're wondering, what is PM2.5, what is fine particle pollution? These are very tiny particles that come from combustion sources, that come from burning. And to give you an idea of their size, the 2.5 in PM2.5 is the diameter in microns. And so for context, a human hair is about 60 microns across. So these are only 2.5. They're very, very tiny and can be inhaled very deeply into our bodies. And that's why we're so concerned about them, is the health effects that they wreak on our bodies.
Before we focus on the PM2.5 particulate pollution, what other air pollution is of concern in the Puget Sound region?
We also focus on other pollutants that come from some of the same combustion sources. So in the summertime, we have issues with elevated ozone levels. So people often think of ozone, it's good way up high in the atmosphere, but it's not good to be down low where we're breathing it. So we have issues with ozone in the summertime. We also are very focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions as well that come from some of the same sources, the same combustion sources. And then there's a variety of other pollutants that are called, they're kind of lumped together as air toxics. So these are things like benzene, formaldehyde, et cetera. And the nice thing is a lot of our programs that target these combustion sources, whether it's burning fuel in an automobile or a truck or burning wood in a wood stove or fireplace, when you reduce the PM2.5, you're also getting all these co-benefits where you're reducing the greenhouse gas emissions as well as reducing those toxics that I talked about.
Let's focus now on the PM2.5 particulate pollution. Why is PM2.5 pollution of concern for human health?
As I mentioned earlier, they're very tiny, and there are decades of health research that really established quite well the respiratory as well as the cardiac impacts of these fine particles. So they can be inhaled very deeply. There's different mechanisms that they impact our biology, basically. So they can cause general inflammation in our bodies, and they also can be actually directly translocated into the circulatory system. So there are health studies that show that they actually get directly into the circulatory system. And in that way, they're associated with this whole host of respiratory. So reduced lung function in children, children that grow up in very polluted areas, studies have shown that their lung capacity isn't as great as adults. Asthma exacerbation, more asthma cases, more episodes, basically, when there's elevated levels, as well as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, so more chronic bronchitis. So this whole host of respiratory impacts, as well as these cardiac impacts. So cardiac, including things as simple as, you know, studies showing that it increases heart rate variability, increases blood pressure, all the way to increasing risk of heart attack, heart attacks going up when we have elevated levels, stroke, and even premature death. So these respiratory, these heart and lung impacts are really based on decades of research. It's very well known. Many of the health researchers will use the word causal when they describe this. So this is very well established. And then there's a whole host of new studies being done on things we wouldn't necessarily think about when we think of fine particle pollution. It makes sense. We think of respiratory, then we think of cardiac, but there are studies being done on things that are not directly intuitive. So the examples I'll give are things like diabetes, things like cognitive function, brain development in young children, reproductive impacts, dementia, Alzheimer's. So these, again, are not nearly as well established. This is kind of a growing field, but the research is showing that people are looking at it more systemically. So they started looking at individual systems within our bodies, and now the research is moving on from there.
What are the main sources of PM2.5 in the Puget Sound area?
So the main sources are, again, combustion, which is just a fancy word for burning of anything. And it really varies by season and by location. So if we were to look at a pie chart, if you will, of all the sources of PM2.5 in a community that burns a lot of wood for heat or secondary heating during the winter, that slice of the pie would look really large for the winter months. And then for the summer months, it would obviously shrink. So the general overall pie for the region shows some from your mobile sources, your cars, your trucks, your roads, some from home heating, as I alluded to, some from what we call area sources. So this is, you know, people burning yard waste in their yard in areas in our jurisdiction that can do that type of thing. Some of it even comes from dust. I know I talked a lot about combustion, but there is a little bit that comes from dust. And of course, there is a slice of that pie that does come from what people classically think of when they think of air pollution. When you say air pollution, they usually think of a smokestack. So there's some that comes from industry as well. So again, it will really vary in terms of the season that we're talking about, as well as the location. So for example, if you live closer to a roadway, a bigger slice of your pie is coming from the road versus some of those other sources I mentioned.
How are levels of PM2.5 particles monitored?
Our agency monitors fine particle pollution in our four counties, as well as some sites run by the Washington State Department of Ecology. And so we have a network of a little over a dozen monitors across the four counties. And that information is available on our website. I think you're going to mention it later on, which is pscleanair.org. People can go to that website and see near real-time data collection. And if you're asking about the actual method that we use a couple of different methods to collect PM2.5 information. One monitoring method is what's called the gold standard. So it's basically pulling the air across a filter. Then that filter is very carefully weighed, which gives us the mass, the micrograms. And then we can calculate what the volume is based on the airflow. So that's your microgram per cubic meter. That's the concentration, the level that we talk about. So that's one method that's used. It's more labor intensive. Another method we often use is based on light scattering. So it's using a laser, and then we can measure the amount of light scattering that occurs as that laser moves across the particles themselves, and then there's a relationship or a correlation to get that concentration, that level. That all happens behind the scenes. So what you just see is the level. So if you were to go to our website and look at our map, you would see little dots, and you would see the colors of the dots correspond to the air quality. So green indicates good air quality, and so on and so forth. You can actually click on those dots to get more information about what types of activities would be good for that day. So for example, if we're having an impaired air quality day where we have high levels next to activities like running or jogging, you'll see kind of a thumbs down that'll say, you might want to reconsider that activity that day. It'll also show you the short-term trends. So it'll show you what's been happening at that monitor over the last few days. So it's a lot of information. It's good.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Catherine Strange, Technical Analysis Manager at the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. Our topic is health implications of PM2.5 particulate pollution and steps being taken to reduce PM2.5 particulate pollution in the Puget Sound region. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Are we in compliance with EPA PM2.5 standards in the Puget Sound region?
Yes, we are. We did have a former non-attainment area down in the Tacoma Pierce area, and we worked really closely with that community and many partners to improve the levels. And in that community, really the main focus was on the wintertime wood smoke. And so we removed a lot of old uncertified wood stoves that have a lot higher emissions than the newer ones and got people into cleaner heat sources. And it's really a great story. We saw levels decline very substantially in that area. So we are now in compliance with that standard.
What are the effects on human mortality as the level of PM2.5 goes up?
So there are a lot of health studies on premature death with PM2.5, and they very consistently show that as PM2.5 goes up, typically in these studies they'll say per a certain increase in microgram per cubic meter, you see an increase in overall all-cause mortality. And so it's pretty compelling. It shows consistently as the PM levels rise, you have higher mortality in these populations. The good news is there are actually follow-up studies in some of these areas after there have been programs to improve air quality, and the converse is true. When you reduce PM2.5 pollution, the great news is you actually have lower mortality rates. So it's a great public health story that we can show when PM2.5 is reduced, you have better outcomes.
Would you speak about the data that suggests that no level of PM2.5 particles are safe?
Sure. There are several studies and some recent studies as well that came out just in the last year or so looking at different cohorts and different groups of people and looking at levels that are not just above those national ambient air quality standards you just asked about and looking at what are health impacts in areas that are considered, quote, clean areas. And what they found in several of these studies pretty consistently is that even if you're already below the standard, if you have improvements in that air pollution level, you'll see improvements in those health outcomes. So what it's showing is there are health impacts even below the national ambient air quality standard. And that's why even in our work, even though we're attainment for all these standards, we work on a continuous improvement basis. We always work to further reduce emissions because we know that there's risk with even these lower levels of PM2.5 exposure. It's why we focus on cleaner home heating, cleaner vehicles, cleaner diesel, and that's why we have a lot of programs to that end.
Which groups of people are most affected by PM2.5 particulate pollution? What are the demographics?
So in a nutshell, everyone is affected. Even healthy people are affected when levels are elevated, and particularly sensitive populations. So this includes the very young, children, the very old, elderly, people with pre-existing conditions. So somebody that already has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, chronic bronchitis, is going to be impacted differently than a healthy individual potentially. Pregnant women are also in this cohort of sensitive population.
And how about different racial groups?
This is something that's interesting. It's being explored in several of the studies where it breaks out. It's not well understood yet. Some of the studies break out different groups. And so it's not well understood why certain groups. So, for example, a recent paper showed that for Black people, they had higher mortality related to PM2.5 increases. So the paper had a lot of discussion as to why that was, and I think they're still digging through what potential confounders and things like that are.
How much variation in PM2.5 pollution do we see in different geographical locations within the Puget Sound area? You said a bit about that earlier, but say more.
Sure, it can vary quite a bit, even within cities, if you're closer to a source or move further away from it. And then sometimes it actually is pretty regional in nature. So during the winter, when we call wintertime burn bans, when we have sometimes these fairly regional inversions where basically you have a layer of warm air that traps cold air. So in those times, it's kind of elevated everywhere. But you certainly have a lot of variety as you move closer to and further from sources.
If you look at the air quality over the course of a year, to what extent do you have times that it's unhealthy for people?
We certainly have seasonal patterns, and typically our worst air quality for PM2.5, this is true, our worst air quality tends to happen in those winter months, and this is a combination of both the meteorology that I mentioned. We tend to have stronger inversions setting up in those winter months, as well as the combustion sources. We tend to have a lot of indoor home heating occurring, so the combination of more emissions and the inversion just leads to elevated levels of PM2.5.
What steps are being taken to reduce PM2.5 levels in the Puget Sound area?
So as I mentioned earlier, we've had a lot of programs very focused typically in the Tacoma Pierce area because that's where we had the highest levels to help residents get into cleaner forms of heat. So we've had a very robust wood stove replacement program helping people to change into a cleaner device like a ductless heat pump or a pellet stove or natural gas, etc. So that's been a pretty phenomenal program with almost 5,000 households changed. And then we've also worked closely with partners as part of the Northwest Ports Clean Air Strategy to try and focus on diesel emissions in our port industrial areas, Port of Seattle, Port of Tacoma for our areas. There's also some smaller ports as well. And so we've had incentive programs there to try and engage people to replace older, more polluting trucks. So that's the good news with all these combustion sources. The newer versions of trucks, the newer versions of wood stoves, et cetera, they're all much cleaner. So we've had a lot of incentive programs to try and motivate people to get into cleaner versions of these. With diesel, it's particularly challenging because a lot of these trucks are workhorses. They can last for decades. So trying to get somebody to move to a post-2007 truck is more challenging when they might have more time that they could use the vehicle.
Let's speak in more detail about your diesel solutions program. Why target diesel in the first place?
So the reason we started targeting diesel as a component, so diesel particulate matter is a component of PM2.5. It's just one slice of that pie, if you will, that comes from combustion of diesel fuel. And what we found, and it was very consistent with other findings many years ago, is that in addition to some of the health risks I talked about earlier, diesel is our risk driver for potential cancer risk. So risk of lung cancer, basically. And so we started really focusing on this pollutant to reduce potential cancer risk from air toxics. And where we started many years ago was with the school buses. And the rationale there was these school buses move through our communities. They carry our children, a sensitive population. Many studies showed not only were levels impacting ambient air quality, but also the levels on the bus themselves were elevated. So we started by helping to place diesel particulate filters and oxidation catalysts, et cetera, on those buses. So we started there. Then we started moving on to other areas. So other areas, we've done several different retrofits with, you know, waste haulers. We've had emergency vehicles like ambulances, fire trucks, et cetera. So we've worked with a host of public fleets to improve the diesel emissions from these vehicles.
Would you say a bit more about the sectors from which diesel emissions come?
Sure. They come from a variety of what we call on-road and what we call non-road. So on-road is pretty straightforward. It's basically your diesel trucks, heavy-duty diesel trucks and buses on the road that would typically use diesel instead of gasoline like we use in our vehicles. And then non-road includes things like construction equipment. It includes things like rail and marine vessels, ferries. It includes a whole host of non-road. So there's a lot more variety in the non-road sector than the on-road.
How effective has the Diesel Solutions Program been?
It's been really successful in terms of helping to bring down diesel emissions in our area. We follow that trend in a couple of ways. Through emission inventories is one way where we look at where do we think all the sources are in our area, trying to do an inventory of where they're coming from. And more importantly, we track through our monitoring network the PM2.5 trend, which is improving. And we also track a pollutant. I talked about the light scattering. We also have a device that measures light absorption or black carbon. And so black carbon is not exactly diesel, but it's kind of a nice marker to indicate what's happening with diesel. And so we see a pretty substantial trend moving down where diesel is improving in our region. And we have them placed in our areas, like our port industrial areas. I will say for diesel also, a lot of the fleet, even though it takes a long time for these vehicles because they last so long, the fleet is turning over and the newer diesel engines are much, much cleaner. They pollute just a tiny fraction of what an old diesel engine would emit. So anything we can do to catalyze that fleet turnover is a win for air quality.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Catherine Strange, Technical Analysis Manager at the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. Our topic is health implications of PM2.5 particulate pollution and steps being taken to reduce PM2.5 particulate pollution in the Puget Sound region. How have the levels of PM2.5 particles changed over time in the Puget Sound region as a whole?
They have definitely improved over time. We have a monitoring network that goes back for several decades. Back in the day, in the early 90s and even the 80s, it was focused not on PM2.5, but on what was called PM10. So it was a bigger size fraction. And before that, it was total suspended particulates, which was even bigger. So you can look at these long, decades-long trends across our region and just see the slope go down. So the trend is definitely improving. And that is, again, really a credit to these newer technologies, these newer engines being much cleaner, these newer wood stoves being cleaner. It really is great because we've clearly seen our population increase. So these technologies have managed to even offset more people in our region, as well as, you know, we have a pretty thriving economy as well. So PM2.5 levels are improving. That said, relating back to what we were talking about earlier, we know even though we're improving, we still want that trend to even continue. So we know that our work isn't done. It's encouraging that the trend is down, and we want to see those levels go down even more.
How does the PM2.5 particulate pollution in this area compare to other parts of the country?
That's a good question. It's pretty commensurate with other urban areas. It's actually pretty great that we are an urban area of about 4 million people, and we don't have any non-attainment areas. When I say non-attainment area, that means they're out of compliance with the federal standards. So we have levels that are pretty similar. We look at other regional metropolitan areas. Many of our, you know, similar-sized metropolitan areas do have areas that are above those standards. So generally, we have pretty good air quality when you compare it to other areas around the country.
Would you comment on PM2.5 particulate matter in the smoke from wildfires, such as what we observed last summer?
Oh, yes. Last summer was an interesting one. So definitely of our pie chart of pollution, wildfire smoke was more last year than it has been ever in our region. So the wildfire episodes that we had last August and September were definitely unique for our region thus far. We are wondering as an agency if this, and certainly with partner agencies, if this will become the new norm, if you will, unfortunately, with a lot of biomass that can be burned in our area. What was interesting about our episodes, several things were of interest. First, that some of them were not anywhere close to us. They were from fires in British Columbia. They were from fires in California. A couple of them later in the season were more localized. But it really showed that wildfire impacts from places that aren't even coming within Washington State can really impact our region in a meaningful way. We really encourage people during those wildfire smoke episodes to go to our website to look at what levels are and to plan their day accordingly. One interesting thing, too, was public perception during that time, because there were times when the pollution levels aloft, and when I say that, I mean the pollution levels up high were very high, and so the sun was very obscured. It looked very weird. There was literally some ash falling. And yet on those days, the pollution levels in the breathing area were actually not as elevated as some other days. So it was interesting to see perception versus what actual monitors were showing us. And we always encourage people when they look at the website and they're planning their day, you know, should I go for that run? Should I have that soccer game, et cetera, et cetera? Look at the levels, use that piece of information as you plan your day. And then always, we're not healthcare providers, always listen to your body too. I've talked to people and, you know, the air quality was not as high and they're like, well, I'm feeling it in my chest. And you should listen to your body. That's what we tell people.
What are your plans for the future? What is likely to be most effective in bringing down the levels of particulate pollution?
As I mentioned, really trying to encourage any kind of fleet turnover. When I say fleet, I mean the vehicle fleet as well as the fleet of home heating, old wood stoves, which are not nearly as efficient. Trying to reduce heating with wood would be super helpful. Also, anything that people can do to support not taking a trip. So what we call, the term is mode shift. So it's getting more people on the bus, getting more people, if it's a short trip, that can do a bike ped, when I say bike ped, walk there or take a bike there. So anything to promote people being able to not even get into a vehicle is going to be helpful. And as I mentioned, a lot of these have a lot of co-benefits for greenhouse gas emissions. So anything we can do to be improving not only our PM2.5 pollution, but our greenhouse gas emissions.
What advice do you have for people who would like to monitor PM2.5 levels on their own property or in their own homes?
Oh, that's a great question, very timely, because there are several manufacturers coming onto the market right now with these small sensors that can show people what is my air quality like right here. So you can put them in your homes. There are several on the market. I would encourage people to definitely try them out, to use them in a relative sense and take them with a grain of salt. So some of them are more mobile, and by that I mean like you can carry them around and you can, you know, walk down the road and see how things vary as you come to an intersection or walk by a smoker, et cetera. And so using them in a relative sense is great that way. You could try out different ways to get to your school or different ways to get to work and see, well, is the busier road? Are the pollution levels higher? Which would be the better way for me to take? So in a relative sense, it's great. I would encourage them also, you know, if they can, to go to our website and see how they're comparing to like, our regulatory monitors, which are calibrated very carefully and maintained very carefully. So I think these devices are great and they get people engaged and they're a great communication tool. I also think people should take them with a grain of salt when they look at them for an absolute value, because we have several of them and we've tried them out and we're finding that some of them are great in a relative sense. And they have some bias. So if you're just looking at the absolute number, take it with a bit of a grain of salt and take a look at what our regulatory monitors are showing for your area.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to leave our listeners with, you know, we are fortunate to live in a place with relatively good air quality. The trend is improving, and we still have a lot of work to go.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Catherine Strange, Technical Analysis Manager at the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. For more information, check on the web at pscleanair.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. go to the podcast section of KEXP's website at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.